are, and they could put two and two together. And, of course, there were rumors. Some of the rumors traced back to intel I'd received from the Burgermeister, and it made me nervous about UNEFHQ's information security. It pissed me off that I was supposed to treat intel as secret when it was flying around the rumor mills already. I couldn't even tell my guys which rumors were total bullshit and which intel had at least a grain of truth to it. There was plenty that was total bullshit. Now my fire team had a new sergeant, and they were stationed at Battalion HQ, wondering if they'd done anything wrong. Nobody believed the bullshit story that our EOT had been pulled out of test score because the mission was over. Stupid UNEFHQ hadn't even been smart enough to rotate in another EOT. They simply abandoned test score. Sure, that didn't look suspicious at all. EOTs were still in place all over the sector, except for the one village where I'd been meeting with the Burgermeister. Here's how thin UNEF's cover story was. The crew chief on the Dumbo that I flew to the launcher, a guy I'd never met in my life, asked me what I'd done that UNEF had to pull our EOT out of test score. There were rumors of a scandal, rumors so juicy that they had flown around the planet at the speed of light. All the InfoSec measures implemented by UNEF could be defeated by two guys sharing a rumor over their Z-phones. Chapter 6. Fort Arrow. At the launch complex, I reported to a Captain Price in the admin building, a structure UNEF had taken over from the Ruha who had managed the launcher operations. Coming in from the airfield, I saw a whole lot of Ruha outside the fence line of the base UNEF called Fort Arrow. Since humans didn't know how to operate or maintain the giant launcher railgun that shot cargo into orbit, the biggest change had been which flag flew over the base. Hamsters still ran the reactor and the rest of the launcher complex. UNEF had carved Fort Arrow out of the workers' town that grew up next to the fusion reactor, taking over the existing buildings and putting minimal effort to repurpose them for military use. It made sense. UNEF wasn't planning to stay on Paradise long enough to invest in infrastructure. There was a semi-secure corridor between the airfield and Fort Arrow. On either side of the corridor were hamsters going on about their lives. Captain Price's aide kept me waiting almost an hour while I sat and watched the door to Price's office. He was in there. I could hear him talking on the phone, and long silences. It wasn't like he was so busy that he couldn't take a few minutes to welcome me aboard. They hadn't served breakfast on the Dodo. I was hungry and wanted to scrounge up some food before the dining facility shut down. Finally, Price stepped into his doorway, looked at me in a distinctly unfriendly manner, and grunted when I got to my feet and saluted him. Bishop. It wasn't a greeting so much as a statement. Yes, sir. Sergeant Bishop reporting. There were no order papers for me to hand to him. Everything was on our phones or tablets. In his office, he didn't tell me to sit. I stood at semi-attention to the right of the doorway. Bishop, he said again, pointing to something I couldn't see on his tablet. The Barney guy. Shit, I was really getting sick of that. I have your orders here, he continued, and your personnel file. Lack of discipline seems to be a pattern for you, and acting rashly. We're not going to tolerate any of that here at Fort Arrow. You may think your 15 minutes of fame entitles you to special treatment. I didn't bother to protest because he had already made up his mind about me. That's a November golf. You got that? Yes, sir. Low profile, I told myself. Major Perkins, through her UNEFHQ, wanted me to keep a low profile. Keeping my mouth shut was the first step. A simple yes from me wasn't good enough, apparently. Price had a chip on his shoulder and a soapbox to stand on, and he was going to take full advantage of having a captive audience. You may have heard that Fort Arrow is a dumping ground for screw-ups and malcontents. Actually, I hadn't heard that, and I hadn't heard anyone use the word malcontent since, like, elementary school. UNEFHQ thinks that because the Ruha need the launcher to ship their grain off-world, Fort Arrow is safe from attack, and we don't need a significant security presence here. Okay, this wasn't about me then. Price had a problem with UNEF HQ and I was a convenient target of his unhappiness. They're wrong. The launcher's importance means that it's the first place the Ruhar will try to capture if they ever try to retake the planet. This is an elite force. He tapped a finger twice on his desk for emphasis with a clicking sound. What the gesture did for me was make me think the guy needed to trim his fingernails. Elite. We at Fort Arrow need to show the Ruhar that we are so strong here, it's not worth them trying to take this site. I nodded silently. Silent because I didn't want to disagree with his flawed logic. If the Ruhar managed to get a powerful enough fleet into orbit to chase the Kristang away, then humans trapped on the surface would be a speed bump. The hamsters could sit in orbit and use precision strikes with railguns, mazes, and smart missiles to eliminate human resistance, no matter how strong a force was garrisoned at Fort Arrow. We don't have a place for you here, and you could use some help keeping out of trouble. I'm assigning you to convoy escort duty. You'll report to Staff Sergeant Lombard in the morning. Try to keep your nose clean and... Sir? Price's aide called from outside the office. Colonel Young is on his way here right now. Colonel Young strode in, dropped his pack on a table, ran a hand across his face to wipe the sweat off, and stuck his head in Price's office door.
God damn it. We're in this shit now. Our buddies de Kristang are pulling their destroyer out tomorrow. That leaves us with a single frigate in orbit for fire support. Who do you want to bet that frigate bugs out at the first sign of a hamster warship? The old man wants contingency plans in case the Ruhar come back. We need to be prepared to defend this planet on our own. That bad, sir? Captain Price asked, startled. Bad enough that they want a platoon to pull out of here tomorrow and redeploy to beef up security at a couple logistics bases. UNEF figures no way the Ruhar would risk damaging the cargo launcher, so they're stripping us thin to cover more likely targets. What?
Colonel Young reacted to a raised eyebrow from Price. He turned to the right and noticed me.
Who are you, Sergeant?
I saluted crisply. Bishop, sir. I was transferred here. Just flew in this morning.
Bishop, huh? Yeah, you're the Barney guy. We heard you were coming.
I was never going to escape that.
You can clear out, Sergeant, and keep your mouth shut. Not that we can keep this quiet anyway,
Young said with a sigh.
Yes, sir.
I walked out as fast as I could without completely losing my dignity. The convoy escort team I was assigned to was a good group, led by a green-as-grass second lieutenant who was smart enough to listen to a staff sergeant. Captain Price was right. There wasn't a place for another sergeant on the convoy team, so I filled in as basically an experienced specialist, did what Staff Sergeant Lombard told me to do, kept my mouth shut, and maintained a good attitude, at least on the outside. I still wore sergeant stripes, carried a sidearm, and the personnel system still listed me as an E-5, so I hadn't been busted down in rank. Yet. Overall, the assignment wasn't bad. I did get to see a bigger slice of paradise, from equatorial jungles, over mountain passes, and down to the grasslands. It was a nice planet. Too bad it was infested with hamsters and we had to hand it over to the Kristang after E-Day. Paradise would have made a very nice second home for humanity. And since we couldn't even get to planets in our home solar system without help from aliens, that was only wishful thinking. A typical convoy trip was 4 or 5 days out, 4 or 5 days back, hauling grain and other hamster food. Hamster civilians left the planet via the space elevator, not the launcher, so we didn't have to deal with the chaos of unhappy hamster families. We didn't encounter any trouble from the Ruhar, other than minor, annoying, and random acts of sabotage here and there. I interpreted those as hamsters giving the finger to UNEF. That I could understand. We humans were the occupying force, acting as goons for the Kristang in the eyes of the Ruhar, and if I was in their situation, I'd be feeling defiant. Some of the Ruhar families had been here for 3 generations, set down roots in the fertile soil of paradise, and they'd been peacefully farming and minding their own business until the recent wormhole shift caused the Kristang to decide the time was ripe to take back the planet. UNEF required convoy escorts to prevent problems. The thinking was the hamsters may become troublesome as we approached E-Day and it set in that they really were leaving this planet behind, likely forever. The Chinese and French had found hamster stragglers in places that were supposed to have been fully evacuated, and troops of every nationality had found hidden caches of hamster weapons. Maybe the Ruha weren't intending to go quietly after all. In between convoy trips, we had a day or two at Fort Arrow, which meant sleeping in a real bed, eating hot food that someone else cooked for you, and being able to use the gym, baseball fields, and other opportunities for R&R. Fort Arrow even had a large swimming pool, the best feature of which was being able to see female soldiers in swimsuits. Unfortunately, not one single damn time that I went to the Fort Arrow dining facility were they making cheeseburgers. I had good fish and chips, a decent meatloaf that was more loaf than meat, and chicken pot pie that was more veggies and crust than chicken. Meat of any kind seemed to be getting in short supply on Paradise. We heard rumors that the supply ships from Earth were delayed or operating on irregular schedules, or that space battles elsewhere in the sector were causing the Theranin to reroute their ships. Soon after we humans took over the launcher from the Ruha, the UNEF base commander had ordered a garden to be planted, so we would have fresh greens to eat. Fresh tomatoes, melons, onions, spinach, peppers, all stuff you'd see at a typical farmer's market. I knew the situation was getting worrisome one day when the only lunch options at the Fort Arrow DFAC were spinach salad and vegetarian fajitas. Sure, spinach is a good, cheap source of protein, and it was tasty enough when I loaded my salad up with walnuts and croutons. But sometimes a soldier wants a hunk of meat to chew on, and cheese, and a bun, toasted, with ketchup. Fried onions would be nice. As we approached Fort Arrow at the end of my fifth convoy trip, we were looking forward to 3 days of R&R on the base because our vehicles would be down for regular maintenance. Private Pope leaned toward me to talk over the hum of the truck's electric engine. Sergeant, you got plans for R&R tomorrow? When I joined the convoy unit, the initial reaction was first, the inevitable curiosity about my minor celebrity, and second, wondering how I'd screwed up enough to get assigned to convoy duty at Fort Arrow. I took the Barney jokes in good humor. I heard the jokes a million times by now and had a good-natured reply ready for all of them. Our LT was skeptical about me at first. Then Staff Sergeant Lombard let me handle some of the workload, take care of minor administrative stuff that wasted his time. So once people saw Lombard thought I was okay, I was accepted. And that felt good. No plans, why? The weather forecast was hazy, hot, and humid. Chance of afternoon thunderstorms. Typical near the equator this time of year. There's a crashed Kristang starship a couple miles north of the base, Pope explained. A group of us are going to check it out if you want to come with us. A starship fell out of orbit? Damn. Is there anything left of it? I didn't try to conceal my eagerness. Uh-huh. I've seen pictures from people who've been there. They say it's a frigate. It's from the battle when the Ruha took this place from the Kristang the last time, so it's old, and the jungle had swallowed up some of it, but the major structure is still there. The hamsters cleaned up the weapons and the reactor. UNEF discourages us from poking around there because the Kristang are sensitive about it, but lots of people do it. Yeah, I'd love to go. I suppressed any thoughts about taking souvenirs. The Kristang would likely very much frown on that. Thanks. We made plans to head out to the downed ship early the next morning. As we were eating breakfast, Private Crockett walked over to us quickly and whispered, "Hurry up, let's get out of here. There's an Indian general flying in to visit. He's given a speech right after lunch, and they want all hands here at the DFAC to give him a good crowd." We all groaned. No one wanted to sit in the stuffy dining facility listening to another boring speech. We gobbled up powdered eggs and toast, grabbed peanut butter sandwiches for lunch, and practically ran across the base to disappear into the jungle as soon as we could. Anyone sitting around with not enough to do was for sure going to get voluntold to fill seats in the DFAC. A couple miles to the downed ship turned out to be more like 10 miles, and there wasn't a road, so we walked. Enough people had been this way that there was a sort of trail through the jungle. I say sort of because the trail had evolved as each group of people figured out better ways to get there. Avoid hills, find shallower places to cross streams, avoid mud and dense pockets of thorns. It would have been better if the trail had been marked, which it wasn't. Whatever native animals lived in this jungle also had created trails, and there were lots of dead ends. As a substitute for markings, We tried to follow whichever trail appeared to have had more traffic. This turned out to be a bad idea, as the people who had gone before us were idiots. I sank up to my knees in muddy jungle streams more than once. It was hot and humid, and there were large, creepy insects in the jungle. Creepy even though we knew, or were told, their venom couldn't affect us. I kept swatting and squishing insects that dropped from the trees and landed on the back of my neck, hoping for an easy meal. Insects clearly hadn't gotten the memo about humans not being edible to the native biology of paradise. Or they were just hateful MFers and wanted to bite or sting something. The chance of afternoon showers, which in the tropics is the equivalent of chance the sun will rise in the morning, turned out to be a thumping walloper of a downpour. It only lasted less than 5 minutes, which seemed a lot longer when we were all soaked to the skin in the first minute. Some of us tried to huddle under the larger trees with broad leaves until lightning started crashing down. Then we all got as far away from trees as we could. When the rain stopped, the sun came out, and it was like walking through a steam room. Big, fat, sun-warmed water droplets dripped off the trees onto our heads. The air was thick enough to cut with a knife, and whatever insects had been sleeping before the storm were awake and hungry now. It was, we all agreed, way better than listening to a speech in the DFAC. I'd never have found the ship on my own. We humans all relied too much on advanced technology. Even on Earth, I'd started to lose basic skills like map reading and field navigation. Finally, we stumbled onto the crashed ship, mostly by following a trail of discarded MRE wrappers. From what I'd heard, I expected there to be nothing left but the bones of the ship's frame. To my delight, it was way more intact than I'd feared. It was a big ship, and if Krestang frigates were this size, I'd not want to meet one of their larger combatants in space warfare. A large piece of the aft section was missing. I guess where the Ruhar had removed the fusion reactor, and the nose of the ship was buried in the swampy ground. Between the two further sections of broken ship that I could see, I estimated it was much larger than a nuclear submarine, maybe as long as an aircraft carrier. Maybe longer. Most of the ship was engine, or engineering section. I didn't know whether that part of the ship had been pressurized with breathable air, but it seemed practical to do that since the engines must have needed maintenance. We were able to get inside the ship and roam around a bit with flashlights. There weren't many dangerous animals on Paradise, which is a damn good thing, as the only weapon we had with us was my sidearm. Even the inside of the ship was dirty, muddy, and overgrown, crawling with insects. After we all poked around a while, we got bored, and of course then we got hungry. Someone suggested we climb on top of the ship where we wouldn't be sitting on swampy ground. It was a good day, away from the base, out in the bush, exploring something new, nobody shooting at me. I had a canteen full of bug juice, a peanut butter sandwich, a hoo-ah bar, and a little bag of dried fruit. What else could a guy ask for? Rumor had it chicken was on the menu at the DFAC tonight, and I planned to take a swim in the base pool, maybe play basketball or softball later. Shading my eyes, I looked up to check the position of the sun, or local star, or whatever the correct term was, and saw the distinctive twinkling light of a starship jumping into normal space. Another Ruhar transport ship? We've been seeing those regularly enough. It still fascinated me, the idea of ships traveling faster than light. Another twinkle. Not unusual. Ruhar transport ships sometimes came in multiples, and they were always escorted by Krestang ships, usually frigates. Not that I could see the difference in one ship to another from dirtside. More twinkling lights. And more. A lot more. Hey, guys. Pope pointed at the sky. That's a lot of ships up there. Was the Krestang task force back? My Z-phone gave a strangled squawk and went silent. Oh, shit. That wasn't anything good. I tapped the icon for the command channel, and all I got was static. I was already trying to get anyone at all on my phone, when there was a burning streak of light down from the sky and a massive explosion in the direction of Fort Arrow. A fountain of dirt exploded upward on the skyline, evolving instantly into a mushroom cloud. We'd all seen that in training videos. A railgun strike. A small, dense dot of tungsten or more likely some exotic alien material, boosted to a significant percentage of light speed, burning a hole through the atmosphere and slamming into the planet. Into Fort Arrow. As I watched uselessly, mouth gaping, there were more contrails zipping down to impact the base. These contrails curved as they flew. Hypervelocity smart missiles following on the heels of the railgun darts. There were more explosions, all coming from Fort Arrow. Everyone had the same reaction that I did. First, holy shit. Second, what the hell do I do now? Without orders, we all scrambled down off the crashed ship. I looked around in case something had changed in the minute since I'd last checked, but the situation was the same. 17 people. And between us, we had precisely one weapon, unless you counted knives. My sidearm wasn't going to be much use against the Ruhar. Sergeant, what's going on? Sergeant. Every face was turned toward me. Shit. Everyone else was a private, a specialist. Damn it. I was a sergeant, wasn't I? This morning I was supposed to be just another guy on a hike through the woods. Now the chevrons on my uniform top and my sidearm meant I was supposed to do something. Anything. You know as much as I do. Anyone got a signal on their phone? People shook their heads negatively. At least everyone had the sense to check their phones after the base was hit. Ruhar must be jamming us. I'm not even getting a navigation signal. I also couldn't use the proximity feature to see on the map the phones of people right around me. The whole system must be dead. All right, people, the network is down. Turn your phones to receive-only mode. That supposedly prevented the Z-phone from transmitting any signal, even location. UNEF suspected the Kristang had a way of tracking us even if the phone was in stealth mode, but we didn't have much choice. The last thing we needed was hamsters tracking us. Hopefully they couldn't tap into Kristang technology. With the base likely knocked out, a cluster of 17 humans would be a nice secondary target. Grab your gear, I said automatically, ignoring that gear at this point was backpacks and canteens. We're going back to base ASAP. Base? Private Collins pointed at the pillar of smoke, and as he said the word, there was another explosion from that direction.
There's no base. There can't be anything left of it.
We don't know that. We're sure as hell not hiding here in the jungle. We're going back to base because there may be people there who need our help, and because it's our job, our duty. If you need more motivation, the Kristang are our only ride home and our only way to get food shipped in. If the Ruhar get established here before the Kristang come back, we're all in deep shit.
If the damn lizards come back, Collins grumbled.
How are we going to stop the hamsters from setting up camp here again? We don't even have weapons.
We're going to keep them busy and off balance and hit them whenever we can, buy time for the Kristang task force to get back here. I looked around at a group of people I knew only vaguely, people from multiple convoy escort teams. I didn't even know all of their names. We'd only met when we assembled at the DFAC that morning. I don't know all of you. Some of you I've been on convoy duty with, and some of you told me you didn't come all the way out here to play nursemaid to a bunch of hamsters. That was a common complaint within UNEF. This is our chance to hit back.
Sergeant, I'm all for duty, Pope said. But Collins has a point. What are we supposed to do with our weapons?
Specialist Amaro spoke up. I swear she stood on tiptoes and raised a hand like she was in elementary school.
There's an ammo dump outside the base. It's at a hamster storage depot, built into the hillside along the access road that runs along the launcher track. I delivered supplies there a month ago. I think it's still there.
Mant, there are guards? I asked. If not, we'd probably have no way to get the bunker door open.
Two guys, the day I was there. There's a big heavy door at the entrance and kind of a little shack we put up for the guards. The hamsters didn't have anything like that. They left it unmanned. It's maybe, I don't know.
She looked at the map on a Z-phone.
Shit! Without the GPS feature, I don't know where it is. Not far. You can see where they cut into the hill for the access road.
She pointed up to the west, to a horizontal scar along the mountain. Only a section of the cut was visible through the trees or whatever they were. I'd seen the access road briefly on my flight into Fort Arrow. The maps said there was an access road running along both sides of the launcher, with side roads going to the launcher tube itself about every kilometer or half mile or something like that. All right, anyone else been there?
No.
Head shakes all around. I was tempted to climb on the ship to get a better view.
Can we go straight to the access road from here?
Amaro looked stricken.
I don't know, Sergeant.
In the military, I don't know is a perfectly acceptable answer, much better than trying to bullshit your way through a situation. Usually, I don't know is supposed to be followed by, but I'll find out.
I think there's a cliff between here and the road. I can't... Damn this thing!
She tapped the screen of her Z-phone. That's all right, Amaro. We've all gotten too reliant on fancy technology and let our basic navigation skills go soft. I know I have. Which was true, since without the GPS I had no freaking idea where we were. I tugged the straps of my pack tight and looked at the faces who were looking at me. Sometimes all people needed was to hear that someone, anyone, had some sort of a plan. People, let's get weapons and ammo. Amaro, you lead off. Set an easy pace. This could be a long run. It was a long run in the heat, at least 3, maybe 4 miles, and it seemed like a mile of it was uphill. It got easier when we got to the access road. Amaro recognized a rock slide and figured out which way to go along the road. We picked up the pace despite the increasing heat and our canteens now being out of water. It was easier to run on the road, and we had the added incentive of seeing Ruhar attack ships buzzing overhead. Whenever we spotted one of those dropship attack birds UNEF called vultures, we dove off the road undercover. Hiding under trees made us feel moderately safer. My guess was with their technology, the Ruhar knew exactly where we were. A small group of primitive humans without weapons weren't worth expending ammo. We came upon the side road that led to the ammo dump. We ran only a quarter mile along the access road before a voice called out from under a bush beside the road.
Halt! You stay right there!
The voice was shakier than I hoped to hear when the speaker was pointing a rifle at my head. Sergeant Joe Bishop, 10th Infantry. Who's in charge here?
You are.
Another voice spoke, and a guy stepped out from behind a tree.
It's just us here, Sergeant. I'm Specialist Rogan, and that's Private Wayne under the bushes.
Shit. I'd been silently hoping someone of higher rank was at the ammo dump to take the responsibility off my shoulders. Rogan tapped the Z-phone on his belt.
Our comms are down.
I noticed Rogan still had his rifle pointed in our direction, barrel slightly down, but with his finger properly poised next to the trigger. He and Wayne were in uniform. The rest of us were in T-shirts and shorts, and they didn't know the new guy claiming to be a sergeant. Rogan looked over my shoulder.
Hey, you're Miller, right? You're on convoy duty.
Yeah, Miller acknowledged. You're on a baseball team. Shortstop?
Second base.
Seeing a face he recognized seemed to satisfy Rogan. He nodded to Wayne, and they secured their weapons.
What's going on, Sergeant?
We know as much as you. We were out for a hike to that crashed ship when all hell broke loose. Either the Ruhar are taking a very broad view of their ceasefire agreement, or they've decided they want to take this planet back.
I thought back to what I'd overheard Captain Price saying. It wasn't sensitive intel anymore. Last week I heard the Kristang pulled out their air cover except for a single frigate. Some kind of fleet action was going on upstairs. I think the Ruhar hit Fort Arrow with a railgun strike and missiles. You couldn't see the base from the ammo dump. A shoulder of the mountain range blocked the view except for the still thick smoke. We don't have comms either. Set your Z-phones to receive-only mode so the Ruhar can't use them to track us. Wayne shot a look at Rogan like they'd already had that discussion, and Wayne had lost.
They must know about this place.
Rogan pointed to the heavy doors at the entrance to the ammo dump.
The hamsters built it, and they'll see we added a guard shack, so they know we're using the place.
The guard shack was a structure that on Earth would be a small tool shed people would have in their backyards. It kept the guards out of the afternoon tropical rains, and that's about it.
I don't see a vehicle, Pope noted. You guys have a Humvee?
No.
Wayne shook his head.
We're supposed to be relieved in 2 hours, and the guys coming on duty arrive in a truck that we'll drive back to base.
You can open those doors? I pointed to the entrance to the ammo dump.
We have the code, Rogan said. But we're not supposed to.
Rogan, if you've been keeping those weapons for a rainy day, that's now. He knew what I meant, despite the mostly cloudless sky. Fort Arrow got hit. As far as we know, we're the only organized resistance around here right now. We need weapons. Open that door. We were in luck. There was mostly weapons in the ammo dump, but also a small store of water and food, which we raided. No salt or electrolyte tablets, unfortunately. I made sure everyone ate some salty peanuts or pretzels to replenish what we'd lost through sweat.
Everyone grab an M4 and ammo. Take extra ammo and get the good explosive-tipped stuff, not the standard rounds. Everyone knew how to identify clips of Krestang ammo. Pope, Stallings, Newman, and, Wayne, and you. I pointed to the five biggest guys in our group. Take two Zingers each. Everyone else takes a Zinger and an AT-4. We don't know what we'll need, so let's bring it all. I hefted a pair of Zingers onto my shoulders to set an example. They were heavy, especially on top of the M4. Thinking a moment, I took off the holster from my sidearm and left it on a shelf. No point bringing a knife to a gunfight. Rogan helped Wayne pick up a javelin.
Hey, are you the Joe Bishop that...
Yeah, Rogan. I'll tell you all about it later. Promise. If there was a later.
Body armor, Sergeant?
Pope asked. I frowned. I'll leave that up to you, I said. And as I said it, realized how cowardly it was of me to not make that decision. Wait, no. No body armor. That was totally against Army regulations. We need to move fast, and we're already overloaded. People nodded. It surprised me. I'd expected resistance to that order. Everyone must have figured that Kevlar wasn't going to be much use against Ruhar infantry weapons like particle beams. Body armor was mostly to protect a soldier's torso from shrapnel damage, not direct hits. Body armor had saved me from serious injury in Nigeria, as much as I'd resented its weight in the heat. If I survived, I'm sure I'd catch hell for violating regs in combat, if there was a UNEF left to reprimand me. We were geared up. People were looking at me again. What next? Jogging back down the access road to the base in full sunlight was a suicidal idea. If the Ruha gunships hadn't cared about us before, they sure as hell would when we got closer to the base carrying weapons. Seeing Ruha aircraft in the sky told me they hadn't only hit Fort Arrow. They had landed troops to take the launcher base complex. That meant Ruha troops on the ground, and if they were on the ground, we could hit them. If we got close enough. Anybody got a map of this place? The launcher complex? The whole thing? I had an idea of the area immediately around Fort Arrow, that's all. Since I'd been there, the launcher had shot cargo into space only 3 times, all when I'd been away on convoy duty. The closest I'd come to seeing it in action had been a contrail streaking into the sky and a low rumble of sound from far away.
"I do, Sergeant," offered Amaro. She jogged over to me and held out her Z-phone.
I took it and scrolled through the plan she downloaded, refreshing my hazy memory. It wasn't much help. The launch tube had a single parallel maintenance access tunnel on the south side, and side shafts connecting to the surface roughly every kilometer. We were on the south side. Getting to the access tunnel meant climbing the mountain over the buried launcher tube. Not an option, with Ruha gunships buzzing around. I looked up from the Z-phone, looked at the soldiers who were waiting for my orders. We could try to hold part of the launcher, fight a battle of attrition which the Ruha would win, hold this position until we were all dead. Trade lives for time in what I knew was a hopeless battle. That didn't sound like a good plan. The Ruha could simply wait us out or deploy some type of gas and immobilize us. I reviewed the schematic again, trying to find inspiration. In battle, decisions needed to be made on the spot, and my brain was already slowed by fatigue. I saw many small compartments off the tunnel where electrical or other equipment was housed. They were dead ends, which would become death traps if the Ruha caught our soldiers in there.
Wait, what is this?
I held up the Z-phone to Amaro. There was another tube, a small one, parallel to the launcher tube on our north side. She squinted in the dim light, then announced,
"That's the conduit for the plasma from the fusion plant. It provides the juice for the launcher magnets."
"How do you know that?"
"Before the war, I was planning to be an electrical engineer," she said. "It interested me. So I got a tour of the launcher when I first got here."
"Nobody had offered a tour to me." "This conduit, it's filled with plasma?"
"That's the superheated gas, right?" "Close enough. Plasma is a fourth state of matter. It's not a gas, liquid, or solid, but it is damned hot."
Still, an idea was forming in my head. The launcher hasn't fired for, what, 3 days now? They wouldn't be feeding plasma into the conduit unless they're charging up for a launch, right?
Yeah. The next launch isn't scheduled for next week, because there isn't a Ruhar cargo ship upstairs to collect it.
She stared at me, eyes wide.
must have guessed my crazy idea.
The conduit is probably cool by now, but...
I looked around the vast cavern that had been excavated by the Ruha. Only a small corner of it was being used by UNEF as an ammo dump. The far end of the space was hidden in an ominous red gloom of emergency lighting, because power had been cut soon after Fort Arrow was hit. We'll need more flashlights. The conduit led straight into the heart of the fusion plant. Like the launch tube, the conduit had many access points for maintenance. The nearest access hatch was less than a kilometer away, back up the road. We passed it on our way to the ammo dump. I led my impromptu squad along the road, all of us struggling with the heat, the extra load of weapons, ducking off the road when Ruha aircraft flew by, and the shock of a nice morning turned to horror. When we got to the access tunnel, I left the others safely outside and took Amuro with me to check out the hatch. It had all kinds of electronic controls and sensors, all of which were currently dead. And it had a wheel. A simple, big, metal wheel. I set the javelin on the ground, gripped the wheel, and turned. A dozen turns and the hatch cracked open with a puff of air. No inferno of plasma to burn my feet off. "Huh," I said as I stuck my head in. It was a dark tube, stretching off as far as my flashlight could shine, about 3 meters in diameter. I flicked off my light and peered into the darkness. No lights shined back from the other end. There were light panels set into the ceiling of the tube. They were dead. She stuck her head in the tube.
"Hey, so this is what it looks like. Bigger than I thought. Power's cut here too, Sergeant. The fusion plant must have gone offline. Or got hit," Amuro guessed.
"The Ruha would have been careful not to hit the reactor. They need the launcher intact. It probably shut down automatically when Fort Arrow got it."
Fort Arrow had been created from part of the town the Ruha had built for hamsters who worked on the launcher complex. It was to the north of the fusion reactor. There were still a lot of Ruha living in the town. They operated and maintained the launcher and reactor. Our technical people were incapable of doing anything useful with the complex alien technology. Fort Arrow was separated from the town by a fence, and the Ruha were restricted to their own areas. I'm sure the Ruha fleet had been careful not to hit the Ruha part of town. I pulled myself back out of the conduit and waved the others forward. "Here's the plan. We're going to counterattack. This conduit tube leads all the way to the fusion plant. We can get out along the way. We'll follow it, pop up in the enemy's rear, and cause some chaos. Let's kill some hamsters this morning." The conduit thankfully remained pitch dark as we ran down it. The entire way my skin was tingling, afraid the Ruha would detect us and lob a few rockets or grenades down the conduit. Either would wipe us out in the confined space, or turn on whatever mechanism generated plasma and fed it into the conduit. That would fry us all to a crisp. Secretly, I was hoping that maybe the reactor had been damaged, that it wasn't only temporarily offline, because damage would mean the plasma couldn't be turned back on any time soon. There weren't any cameras in the conduit that I could see. Having superheated plasma in the conduit when it was working probably meant cameras were not practical. There must be some sort of sensors along the way to monitor the plasma. My hope was such sensors wouldn't be able to detect our presence. Ruha operated the launcher and reactor machinery. Sensors, including all the surveillance gear, I thought were hooked up to Fort Arrow somewhere. I did know that humans operated the security system for the launcher complex and the base. With Fort Arrow having taken hits, I was hoping the Ruha didn't have access to the surveillance feeds, because if they did, they would detect us as soon as we came out of the conduit and entered the base area. What I hadn't counted on were the numerous pieces of equipment we had to stumble over. I had mentally pictured the conduit as a smooth, empty tube, a round hole in the ground. It wasn't. Amuro explained that the plasma was contained in a magnetic field, which required magnets spaced every couple meters, and the magnets required power cables, which required heat shielding, all of which caused running soldiers to trip, fall, and that made people behind to trip and fall. With there being room in the tube for only a single file line, people falling down didn't only cause bashed knees and elbows. It made the entire column halt. What I was most afraid of was somebody's rifle firing accidentally and alerting the Ruha. So I ordered everyone to proceed forward at a brisk but careful walk, and that kept stumbling to a minimum. It was a long journey.
We walked for miles underground in the claustrophobic darkness, with the view never changing except for Ruhan numbers along the wall. Fortunately, the air was cool. Amaro said it was probably the residual cold of the superconducting magnets of the main launch tube bleeding over into the plasma tube, which had been without plasma for days. Other than cursing when people fell or banged into the walls, the squad maintained discipline, minimal talking, and that in a whisper. Whether this was because they were admirably trained or scared shitless like me, I didn't want to guess. I was terrified to the point that the flashlight was shaking in my hand, and I kept swinging it side to side to cover up how badly my hand was trembling. Walking miles underground in darkness gave me way too much time to think. Was I leading these people to a useless death because I couldn't think of anything better to do, anything smarter? The fact was I couldn't think of anything else to do. We were soldiers. We'd been attacked. We fight. Simple. If an officer had ordered me to do what I ordered these people to do, I would have followed without question. I didn't mean it was the right or best thing to do. What I told Collins was true. If the Ruha were taking the planet back, we may all be dead soon. Our only chance for mission success, for survival, was to tie up the Ruha with ground combat, guerrilla tactics if it came to that, and buy time for the Kristang to regain control in space. If the Kristang didn't or couldn't come back, we were dead anyway, and we needed to strike a blow for humanity. Give the hamsters some payback, and show the Kristang that humans could be useful, reliable allies, because that's what the people of Earth needed. When we finally approached the power plant end of the conduit, I could see ahead of us where the conduit curved and branched out, I assumed to where the plasma was generated. Wherever that was, I didn't want to go there. I called a halt and ordered lights to be turned off while Amaro and I looked at the schematic on her phone. I tried to mentally picture where the reactor was in relation to Fort Arrow, to the east, further up the mountain, and closer to the launcher track. If we were near where the plasma conduit branched to connect with the reactor, we'd gone too far. Asking everyone to turn around in the narrow confines of the tunnel and march backwards a long way wasn't something I wanted to do. Amaro, this conduit ends at the reactor or near it?
No, the reactor feeds power to the plasma generator. The generator is the big round structure up the mountain. It looks like a water tower or a petroleum storage tank. There's a tall white building right next to it. We must be close to that.
Oh, yeah. All right. We were close to where I wanted to be, although I'd forgotten how high up the mountain we must be then. I thought that was a water tank. The conduit had been climbing so gradually as we marched that I hadn't thought about it. The launcher was many kilometers long and climbed up and through the mountain from its base west of Fort Arrow to the open end of the launch tube to the east, far up the mountain and on the other side of the ridge. The mountain's bulk protected Fort Arrow and the launcher complex from the sonic shockwave generated when cargo pods left the launch tube and hit the atmosphere. On our convoys, if we were going to be in the sonic footprint of a launch, we had to halt an hour ahead of time, secure our vehicles, and wear hearing protection under our helmets. It had only happened twice for me so far on convoy duty, and we'd been far enough away that the launch was merely a faint streak of light in the sky. Still, I'd felt the ground rumbling from the hypersonic shockwaves. All the buildings in and around the launcher complex, including Fort Arrow, had noise-canceling systems installed in the walls and windows, and the base went on lockdown during a launch. A launch is something I'd been wanting to see. Now I may have missed my chance. Amaro and I squeezed past the column and led the way back maybe 100 yards to where we'd passed an access hatch. The hatches had wheels on the inside also, and this hatch had a small, thick window in the center. Sticking my eye to the window was useless. All I could see was the reflection of my eyeball. It was completely dark on the other side. If there were hamsters on the other side of the hatch, we were screwed. Amaro, get a grenade ready. She nodded grimly, and I slowly started turning the wheel. It didn't squeak, so I spun it as quickly as I could and swung the heavy hatch open. Into a dark corridor. An empty corridor, 30 meters long. The other end had a door. A regular, solid-looking, rectangular door. I waved for Amaro to follow me and the others to stay put, and walked quietly forward. The door had a keypad that was blank, no power, and a lever instead of a wheel. The lever turned surprisingly easily. The door was surprisingly heavy. and beyond was the interior of some type of garage, with a tall, wide roll-up door and a Ruha truck parked to the left. It was simply a truck, hadn't been converted into a Humvee. Probably it was used by the Ruha who maintained the launcher equipment. The garage was hot and humid. There was an air conditioner unit built into the ceiling that wasn't working. Amaro and I snuck around the truck to where there was a regular door that led to an office area. Two well-scuffed tables, a couple worn-out chairs, a workbench, tools, a trash can with wrappers from hamster lunches, and dust. This place, I guess, didn't get used a lot. We crept warily into the office and looked through the dingy windows. It was a great view in one way. We were high up the mountainside, with the launcher complex, reactor, the town, Fort Arrow, and the airfield spread out below us. There was another door to the outside. In front of the big roll-up door was a concrete pad that connected to the dirt access road beyond, and a roof and crane over the pad. The roof would give us cover from spying eyes above. Amara, bring everyone here, and close that hatch in case the power comes back on. An open hatch might send out an alarm. I stepped out under the roof. Fort Arrow was indeed spread out below me, what was left of it. When UNEF created Fort Arrow out of the existing hamster town, we'd knocked down buildings to create a perimeter and installed a fence and minefield, so it was easy to see the outlines of the base. Where the DFAC used to be was a steaming crater, steaming instead of smoking, because the railgun impactor had damaged the wreck building across the street and the cracked swimming pool there had drained into the crater. Missiles had also hit barracks buildings, which didn't make any sense, as the Ruha must have known those buildings would be mostly empty in mid-afternoon. But the base administration buildings were mostly intact, except for damage from being hit by flying debris. Same with most other buildings within the fence line of Fort Arrow. The airfield beyond to the north was a mess. The runways had been cratered so we couldn't fly off any Dumbos, and every hangar had taken a direct hit. Smashed chickens and buzzards were scattered around the airfield. I couldn't see that we'd managed to get a single bird in the air, with the exception of a pillar of smoke coming from the jungle that might have been a downed aircraft. It was a mess. People filed out the door under the roof. I cautioned them to stay under the shadow of the roof and not to wear sunglasses or anything else that reflected sunlight and could give away our position. Most people gasped when they saw the destruction. I heard several people say quietly that we were lucky we'd not been in the DFAC. The DFAC. What Fort Arrow used as a dining facility had been used for a similar function by the hamsters before us. I estimated it could easily hold 400 people. 400. All dead. No way had anyone walked away from that steaming crater. "What's the plan, Sergeant?" Pope asked. My plan had been for us to infiltrate the town around Fort Arrow and use cover of the hamster buildings there to harass the Ruha forces, figuring they'd fight us house to house rather than blow up half their town to get us. We could tie them up for many hours, even days, giving the Kristang time to take back control upstairs. As long as humans held part of the town, the Ruha wouldn't risk operating the launcher. The reason I'd brought so many Zingers along is we had no chance to hold out if the Ruha could float in the sky above us and pick us off with precision strikes. Simply firing a single Zinger once in a while would force the Ruha close air support to pull back and change their tactics. I know because in Nigeria I'd seen that rebels, blindly firing unguided RPGs at our helicopters, made our air cover scurry for cover. To the north, beyond the airfield, two pairs of vultures were circling. One pair providing cover as the other pair fired missiles and strafed the jungle. Amaro pointed to the action. Some humans must have survived and escaped the airfield to fight on. As we watched, a pair of Zingers burst out of the jungle and raced toward one of the vultures. The first missile was hit with a particle beam and went off course. The second missed but exploded close enough that the vulture staggered in the air and wobbled off toward the airfield trailing smoke. "Binoculars," I ordered, holding my hand out to Pope. I stepped back into deeper shade and scanned the airfield. Several dodos were being serviced on the tarmac, and a pair of whales were unloading. Dodos were small dropship transports, while whales were huge dropships, bigger even than the Dumbo aircraft I'd flown in. Whales could carry big cargo down from orbit. They had doors at the back end and a ramp like a cargo aircraft. One of the whales at the airfield was unloading a buzzard that had its wings folded. "Shit. That's not good," I said quietly. Not quietly enough. "What?" Pope asked. If they're bringing in buzzards already, they must be confident they'll be here for a while. How are we going to get down into the town without being seen? I hadn't considered that we would come out of the conduit so far up the mountain. We must have been 500 feet above the town. Why hadn't I realized it?
Incoming!
Someone behind me shouted. With a high-pitched roar of turbines, two dropships came over the ridge behind us, flew near the garage or whatever was the structure we sheltered in, and flared into hover mode to land at the airfield. It was a Dodo, escorted by a Vulture. We all squeezed against the roll-up door as far under the roof as we could. I watched as they landed, and as they settled down, one of the whales took off in a cloud of dust, gained altitude, and flew close to us, climbing over the ridge behind us and gaining speed rapidly. I watched its belly slide across the sky as it passed us, its big, fat, vulnerable belly. Huh. Just like that, I had an idea. This is the flight path now. We're right under the flight path. Whenever I'd been at Fort Arrow, I'd seen aircraft approach from the east or west, sometimes the north, but never from the south, never coming in over the mountain. That had changed. Our guys over there in the jungle, they've got the Ruha scared to fly in from that direction. Shit! They're flying right over us. They don't know we're here. With the binoculars, I looked down at the other whale that was still unloading. Some cargo was coming down the rear ramp. From the number of troops climbing down the stairways on the ship's side and lined up on the tarmac, the whale had mostly carried troops. A whale, according to the info provided by the Kristang, could carry up to 600 passengers. Judging by the gear the troops on the tarmac were loaded down with, I figured a troop carrier whale could hold the maximum number of people. The Vultures above the jungle beyond the airfield were still firing an occasional missile at whoever was down there. If we could shoot down even one dropship from our position, the Ruha would very likely halt operations at the airfield until they were confident they'd rooted out all human resistance in the area. That would delay their occupation schedule for the launches significantly. Maybe even force them to divert dropships and troops from other areas. And that would give our forces elsewhere on Paradise a break. Even if the Kristang didn't, or couldn't, come back to Paradise, surely they would eventually hear of UNEF's firm stand at the launcher and boost in the Kristang's opinion of humanity's combat usefulness had to help the people back home. Which was the whole point of the UN Expeditionary Force. Our forces had no possibility of actually defending Earth from the Ruha. We needed the Kristang to do that for us. UNEF had gone to the stars in order to give the Kristang a reason to care whether Earth was conquered by the Ruha or not. In a way, UNEF's mission was to save the world. When you're facing the strong possibility of being trapped forever on an alien planet controlled by the enemy, having a dramatic rationale for your mission makes it feel better. I handed the binoculars back to Pope. Pope, you and, Wayne, can you get across the road and under those trees there? I need a spotter to see what's coming over the ridge behind us. Hold up fingers to give us a count with your right hand, with your left hand, A fist means a whale. Holding your palm open, face down, is a dodo. And palm open, face up, is a vulture. Got it? I didn't want to waste zingers on a vulture. We needed to make a bigger impact than shooting down a 2-seater gunship. Pope looked right and left. Yeah, we'll go down the road under a tree cover on this side, to where those trees are overhanging the road, cross there, and make our way back. Good. Leave your zingers and AT-4s here. As soon as we fire zingers, you run back here. We're going back into that conduit for a quick run to the next exit. The Ruha would shortly turn the garage into a pile of rubble after we shot at their aircraft. Everyone else get your zingers ready. Amaro, see if you can get this roll-up door open. We'll need to make a quick exit. I shrugged off the strap to one of the zingers I carried, flipped open the targeting panel, and pressed the first button to activate it. The weapon seeker would stay active for several hours now. Pope and Wayne set their missiles down, peeked out under the edge of the roof, and sprinted off under the trees. In a couple minutes, they were under a tree across the road from me. We were able to communicate by talking loudly. The hand signals had been for communication when enemy aircraft were flying loudly overhead. Almost as soon as Pope and Wayne got settled under the trees, we heard aircraft approaching. One Dodo and one Vulture. I shook my head and gestured thumbs down with one hand. If no more tempting targets appeared soon, I'd settle for a dodo. I had to worry about Ruha troops driving along the access road and seeing us. Surely the Ruha were going to recon the whole area. Another aircraft approached from behind us. A single vulture. Again, I gave the thumbs down. Checking my people, I could see they were so keyed up that we needed to do something soon. Check your safeties, people. Nobody fires until I give the signal. I made people acknowledge my order one by one, looking each person in the eye. Myself, I tried to act calm, even bored. I stifled a fake yawn. Damn, I wish they'd get here soon. I'm hungry, I complained, and that drew some nervous laughter. The whale at the airfield finished unloading. The Ruah troops had marched off the tarmac into the jungle, and it lifted off. This whale flew almost directly over us. I could read some of the markings on its belly and wings. As it approached, I made sure everyone saw my thumbs down. If we had to, I'd attack an empty ship on its return flight, and that wasn't my preference. Then I did get bored. A bit. After that whale took off, maybe 10 minutes went by with no flight activity in the area other than the pair of vultures over the jungle. They weren't strafing or firing missiles anymore, and we didn't see any more zingers coming from the jungle either. With the lull in air traffic, I started to question not shooting at that dodo or the empty whale that had passed over us earlier. Either would have accomplished our main objective of making the Ruah shut down flight operations. Still, I wanted to hit the hamsters, hit them hard, make them pay for all the people who died at the Fort Aero DFAC. While we waited, I had people police the area. After we triggered off the zingers, we needed to run back into the conduit immediately and not waste time picking up things we dropped. Shit, I should have left the access hatch to the conduit open, not waste time spinning that big heavy wheel. Too late now. Lesson learned.
Whales!
Wayne shouted and waved his arms. Pope had the binoculars to his eyes and waved one hand excitedly. Wayne held up a fist and two fingers, then palm open face up with two fingers. Two whales, escorted by two vultures. We couldn't hear them yet. They must have been approaching at high altitude. Then we could hear them.
This is it, people, I shouted. Do not fire until I give the order. We've got two whales. People on this side target the first whale. People on this side, you're with me on the second whale. Stay under the roof for now.
I was so keyed up that I forced myself to double-check my zinger safety was on. As the screaming sound of whale jets got louder, I shuffled close to the edge of the concrete pad. What did we know about whales, I tried to recall. They were well protected for a dropship with multiple defensive particle beam turrets. With 15 of us ready to fire zingers at only two targets from close range, we had a good chance to get a hit. At low altitude and slow airspeed, I was hoping a stricken whale wouldn't have time to recover before slamming into the mountainside and crashing down the slope. I stuck my head out from under the roof to see where the whales were. They were close. They would pass slightly to the east of us rather than directly overhead. Neither of them had their active stealth engaged.
Get ready, I ordered loudly, and stepped out from under the roof. Arm seekers!
With the safety off, the targeting display lit up, I centered the crosshairs on the rear of the trailing whale on the rear port side jet. The jet was angled almost fully down, providing more lift than forward thrust, as the whale was on final approach, the most vulnerable point of its flight profile. Low and slow. Does everyone have a target acquired? I shouted, then repeated the question. We needed to shoot soon. With 15 of us standing in the open, holding zingers to our shoulders, we were sure to be spotted by the escorting pair of vultures soon. 14 people acknowledged they had solid locks on target.
Ready? Ready? Shoot!
I toggled off my zinger, and 14 other missiles leapt from their launch tubes. The zinger launched from the disposable tube with a magnetic pulse, so the back blast from the rocket wouldn't kill the user. The rocket didn't kick on until the missile was 50 meters away. Then the rocket motor kicked on, and I almost lost sight of the missiles as they went into super acceleration. It all happened so fast. I don't know how many of our zingers were diverted, disabled, or killed outright by the whale's defenses. What I do know is both whales staggered in the air as front and rear portside jets on both whales exploded and were torn off. Other missiles ripped into the bellies of the two unlucky ships. The whales have belly jets and the ability to hover on them alone. That feature didn't help them that day. I had a recurring nightmare of that moment, what I think, I hope, is a false memory. Something I could not have seen. Something that could not have happened. Yet I have an incredibly vivid memory burned into my brain.
The passenger-slash-cargo compartment of a whale does not have any windows. Windows are weak points in the structure of an aircraft, and the structure of a whale needs to go up and down to orbit hundreds, even thousands of times over its life. There are tiny windows in the side doors. For some reason, there are a pair of small windows on both sides at the back near the